Good morning and welcome to Environment, Energy, Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee. We'll bring the meeting to order. There is a quorum present. And the first thing will be the approval of the minutes. Representative Torkelson, move the minutes.
Move the minutes.
Representative Hilty, second. Any questions on the minutes, additions, corrections? Being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, the first item of business today will be House File 55, Representative Hackbarth. Representative Hackbarth moves House File 55 to be approved by the committee and moved to the Committee on Ways and Means.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, you probably know this bill a lot better than I do. This is the lands bill that was that we had last year, and it was contained in the Game and Fish bill, rolled into the Game and Fish bill. The controversial part of that bill was the Game and Fish bill, not the lands portion. And there's some... The DNR has some issues that have to be resolved very, very soon in this bill. That's why we're here today now, trying to move this forward and getting it done. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if you have any questions, we do have Mr. Meyer here from the DNR to answer any questions, and also Kathy Lewis from DNR.
Members, questions of Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hackbarth and Mr. Meyer. On page 7, the lines 7.19 to 7.27. Maybe just explaining that provision, and I think we've seen it before, but looking at the real estate market in the last year and just what's the intent here at the 75% sale.
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, I believe Mr. Meyer would like to explain that.
Mr. Meyer, if you introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. The section Representative Hansen is referring to is a piece that was passed last year, actually came from the House provision, that would allow the DNR to sell land at 75% below or 25% below appraised value for the purposes of meeting the remainder of the land sales requirements that started out in 2005. You can see in Chapter 156, it was amended in 2007 and amended again in 2009. Initially, this requirement required the state to sell $6.44 million worth of land. At that time, the DNR was testifying that this requirement will fall on our shoulders as we own or manage most of the land that is in state control here, including school trust, CONCON, and acquired lands. We've been working diligently at this goal. There's still $2.14 million remaining, and the challenges that we see is that the market just is not where our appraisals are, and for us to go back and do reappraisals and things like that costs money, takes time, and if we can do this, we feel it will give us a tool to help meet that goal. You can see also that the language on 7.28, this section does expire June 30th of 2012, or in the case of us having a land sale, we would stop that land sale once we reach that $2.14 million and then go back and readjust those prices again to the full appraised value. Our anticipated goal with this bill is, as Representative Hackbarth said, it was vetoed last spring. We want to get it passed as soon as possible, so then approximately 60 days after signed into law, we will hold this land sale, hopefully to make that $2.14 million dollars, put them in the general fund, and then we will not be unallotted these dollars. And working with MMB over the past years on this, since the DNR does own or manage a lot of land in the state, we would be unallotted most of this $2.14 million if that goal is not reached by this time. It's not something that we want to do or will do in the future. This certainly does not set a precedent for us in any way. We understand the value of land, but we also understand the need to meet this goal. So that's basically the gist of it.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Meyer, so just to be clear, this is only for the 2005 provision. It's not a budget balancing plan for the future. This is just dealing with the past.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, I think our experience has shown us that selling land isn't a budget balancing item. It's taken us 6 years to get to where we are right now, and we still aren't able to meet that goal. We need to sell land to manage our lands more effectively, and that's a whole different conversation to have. But to sell lands to balance the budget, to offset spending, isn't the way to go, especially in this market right now.
Other questions from the committee? Okay, I have a question. Representative Hackbarth, actually probably Mr. Meyer or Ms. Lewis could answer this. all of these provisions that are in this bill are exactly the same as the bill that was passed in the game and the provisions that were passed in the game and fish bill last spring.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, we have taken out several that we have dealt with administratively. The Wyzetta parcel that was there, the Roy Lake parcel, we were able to transfer those without legislation. One item that is in the bill still that we are not pursuing right now, but I have spoke with Representative Hilty on this, and we thought it was best to keep it in the bill still, deals with Carlton County and a piece of land in Cloquet. It would be Section 13 of the bill. The city of Cloquet approached us several years ago in a desire to purchase our forestry station there. It's 535. They're trying to do a big box development. We're agreeable to work with them on selling them the land, but we need to find where our office will move to. It's a fire center. We have a big bullpen to keep our firefighting equipment and an office space. So this language will allow us to do that directed sale to them at some point in time, but we are not in the in the stages of doing that. Cloquet, City of Cloquet, we're still negotiating. It's probably still several years out, but we thought since it was still in the bill, we should keep it in there to allow us to move quickly should the time come. So the fiscal note that will reflect some revenue off of this sale, but that sale is not anticipated anytime soon, if ever, but we want to be able to maintain the flexibility to work with the city to meet
their needs. Do you have any questions on this provision?
No, Mr. Chair, I do not. I have discussed this with Mr. Meyer, and I'm sure that the position of the Cloquet City Council remains the same, and I think it's prudent to leave it in the bill.
Okay, and Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I had just a general question about a comment that was made a moment ago that selling land doesn't have that much of an impact on the deficit, which, of course, we're, as legislators, focused with. But I guess my question to the testifier is, and educate the committee and this member in particular, if we sell this land, does it actually go back into private hands in most cases, or are we just transferring it to cities, counties, or school districts? My question being, does it actually go back into private productive use and start generating real estate taxes and other value to society?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard.
And a follow-up.
All of those, when we do a land sale, it can go to a local unit of government when we offer lands for sale. We have to follow a procedure to offer lands to schools, local units of government first many times. But we also hold many land auctions. We have probably twice a year we do land auctions that the general public comes in and can purchase lands. We need to have legislative approval for any lands that have sharp riparian lands or shoreline attached to them. So many of the parcels that are in the bill are either going to a local unit of government or a directed sale, which we need approval for, or have riparian land. So we try to meet the needs of the local units of government, constituencies, stakeholders, as much as possible through our land management activities.
Representative Beard.
The follow-up then is the fiscal note that we have in front of us. Just remind us whether or not that reflects any of those impacts, or is that strictly costs that monies that accrue to the general fund because the land is sold or transferred? Does it take into account tax revenues that might accrue to a local unit of government because it's back on the tax rolls?
Mr. Chair, members, our fiscal note does not take into account those things. And that fiscal note, as I said, on the back page, you can see the Cloquet 4 station that's listed there at $1 million, which would go into the facilities management account. Yeah. That is not on the books to be sold right now, so that probably shouldn't have been on there, but we just used the fiscal note from last year and kind of updated it. At this time, you can see it talks about money that goes to the land acquisition fund, the consolidated conservation fund, general fund, and the school permanent school trust fund. And then there are costs associated with selling those lands that we need to cover as well, appraisals, real estate transactions, things like that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's helpful.
Okay, other questions by the members? Seeing none, does anyone in the audience want to testify for or against the bill? There being none.
Mr. Chairman,
I have one last question. Is there anything that is that has been omitted from last year's bill that in here that's is not in here, other than the things that we talked about.
Mr. Chair, there was a provision for the Lamprey Pass that's contained in a separate bill now that we took out of here, where the dollars would, it's for an easement that we sold where the dollars would be deposited. That would be in a game and fish bill, I think.
All right. Representative Drazowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Meyer. Just curious, Mr. Meyer, do you kind of have a balance of how many acres of land are we selling versus how many are we buying in this bill? And then I was curious, along the lines of Representative Beer's questioning, did we account for anticipated pilt savings in the fiscal note?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dukowski, I don't have that right now. I can get you that information most certainly. And I should have said, preface my statements earlier, that the department will be having another land sales bill that has new provisions in there, and we'll make sure that we have that information on that one as well. A lot of these are small parcels, and for those who aren't familiar with PILT, it's 0.75% of the appraised value, so $1 million is $7,500 in PILT. That's just the way, the easiest way to calculate it. So I will try to do the total of the acres and also provide you with what that reduction in PILT payment might be.
Okay, any further questions by the members? I see that Mr. Bocek would like to speak to the bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Gary Bocek, Minnesota Conservation Federation. I was just looking for clarification on Section 10 to follow up on Representative Hansen's question, and I got clarification from Mr. Meyer on the transition here. But we oppose that fire sale concept in general, and I understand it's very limited, restricted to the Jim Knobloch language from 05, but a fire sale state lands doesn't make sense to us at this point, but we understand that with these guidelines and limitations, we'll have to support. I didn't think it was in the conference committee report last year, but I know it came with the House bill, but I believe it did make the final. I just want to put that on the record.
And it did. Thank you very much. It did make the conference committee report last year. Okay. Being no further questions or testimony, Representative Hackbarth renews his motion for the bill to pass and be re-referred to the House, the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? There being none, the bill does pass. Next item. We're going to begin resuming testimony on House File 1 and from Wednesday. And the folks that testified previously were the Minnesota Center. Every one of them. Okay. Those that are testifying today are the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, the League of Women Voters, the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, the Land Stewardship Project, Excelsior Energy. And then we have Marshall County Engineer Lon Ani and Brian Kettering and Kelly Bengston and Mike Flanagan. They will all testify as a group, and they're from, appears to me, to be up north, Roseau County, Marshall County, Kitson County, and Pennick County. So if the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy can come forward, Mr. Strand, and then Representative Torkelson will now take the chair.
Thank you, Representative Dill, for your fine work. And we will continue now if Mr. Strand is ready for his testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Strand. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I've held that position for about a year, but for 25 years before that, I was a practicing lawyer working mostly in the environment and natural resources area, for a while representing developers, also for several years representing the state agencies that are directly involved the most with environmental review and permitting, the DNR and the PCA. So I think I have a perspective from a number of different angles on this particular issue. Let me start by saying that the MCA, like I think most organizations, certainly supports the concept of streamlining. I mean, we believe the process for environmental review and permitting should be as efficient as it possibly can be without sacrificing its effectiveness. I think that's a goal that we all share. And we were very gratified by the testimony that we heard, I believe it was on Tuesday, from the agencies about the business process improvement work that they're doing to try to make sure that the process is working as efficiently as it can within the constraints of state and federal law. We want to support the agencies in that effort. We think that should continue. We want to help them in any way that we can. We're also gratified to hear the testimony from the Legislative Auditor's Office. One of the things that has been frustrating, I think, in this debate over the last couple of years is that it's been driven so much by anecdotes. Anecdotes that are at best one-sided, that at worst are simply not true. And I think it's important that we have this discussion on the basis of a common factual footing, that we all have an agreed upon understanding about what the facts really are. And I think the Legislative Auditor's Report can help put us in that position. I don't know what they're going to recommend. We may not like what they recommend, but we do think those 14 case studies that they're doing are going to provide us with some real good background in terms of how these cases really work from an objective point of view, and we think that's important to move this debate forward. I did want to offer a couple of comments about the testimony that Peter Larson offered yesterday. In your packets, there is a letter to the editor that we prepared last year in response to the article that he and Julie Paris did in the Bench and Bar, which summarizes some of our issues. But I want to just address a couple of those this morning. First of all, it's simply not true that environmental review has become obsolete because of the passage of subsequent environmental legislation. The Minnesota Environmental Policy Act here at the state level was actually adopted after most of the major air and water quality permitting statutes. And one of the reasons it was adopted was so that there wouldn't be the kind of siloed review of environmental issues, the piecemeal approach, where we have one group dealing with air issues, another group dealing with water issues, another group dealing with waste issues, and not a lot of communication or interplay between them. What environmental review does is put all of the environmental issues in one place. It makes sure that we don't deal with these issues in a piecemeal basis, and it provides that opportunity for public participation in one place, so that when people are concerned about a particular project, they know that they can participate no matter what the issue is that is of their particular concern. So rather than sending people to different parts of different agencies to deal with specific issues, environmental review offers them a way to participate all at once. That piecemeal approach, or the concern about the piecemeal approach, is also what prompted this legislature to adopt what's called the Environmental Permit Coordinating Act. It's a statute that very few people are aware of. It was passed in 1976. It's still on the books. It provides for the process where all of the different hearings and processes that a project proposer might have to go through can be coordinated into one single set of hearings so that there aren't multiple hearings and multiple processes. It's a process that's on the books. It hasn't been budgeted or staffed, I think, for a long time, but it's something that I think ought to be seriously considered. The second point I wanted to make about environmental review is that it does produce real environmental outcomes. The test is not between, as I think was suggested, between the project as it's proposed and the project as it eventually develops. The distinction is between the project that might have been proposed in the absence of these environmental rules, and then the project that ultimately goes through. And I think, as you heard, several people from the business side of things testify where the effort really goes in, and I think the DNR corroborated this, where the effort really goes in is preparing that project description at the front end of the process. What exactly is the company going to do? What exactly is the company going to do to address the environmental issues? So if there's a particular water quality or air quality standard, how are they going to meet it? And that's what really the focus is in environmental review, is that how question. How are you going to satisfy those standards? What kind of technology are you going to use? Is it the best available technology for addressing those concerns? And that, a lot of times, most of the progress gets made before that initial application comes in the door, just because companies and project proposers know that in order to get through the process, they're going to have to deal with those issues up front. And that's where I think a lot of the progress gets made. A lot of progress also gets made in the EAW process. I mean, I think you heard during the testimony that it is... that EAWs have grown over the years, that the original concept of an environmental assessment worksheet that would be a short, relatively brief document that would focus on the question of whether or not to do an environmental impact statement. Well, it's very rare today that an environmental assessment worksheet will recommend that there be an environmental impact statement. That almost never occurs. What occurs instead, though, is that in order to avoid a finding that a project will have a significant environmental impact, EAWs focus a lot on what's called mitigation. They identify the major environmental issues, and then they explain exactly what can be done to avoid those environmental concerns. And it's the mitigation that leads to that finding that there won't be any significant impact. And that's substance. That's not just information gathering. That's substance. When a project proposer agrees that they will adopt a series of mitigation programs in order to avoid environmental issues, even if their motivation is just to avoid doing an EIS, that's significant progress towards addressing those environmental concerns. So it does have an information gathering component. It's very important for determining what the actual permit conditions will be. But even those EAWs that don't lead to an EIS often have a very substantive role in making sure that the environmental concerns are minimized. In those very few cases where environmental impact statements occur, they're about 10 a year. I mean, that's about all we do in Minnesota. We don't do thousands of EISs. We do about 10 a year. And in those cases, which are the biggest, most complicated cases, it's the EIS that really drives what the permit conditions are ultimately going to be. So that's, again, that's where the substance comes from. Permits are essentially like a set of regulations that apply to a particular company. They're not one size fits all. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on the process that the company is going to go through. It depends on the receiving waters, the receiving air. It depends on the technology that's available. And a permit works out what all of those concerns are going to be and what those standards are going to be. And I think it's something that's typically driven by the EIS in those cases where an environmental impact statement is required. The duplication issue, I think, is something that the statute already addresses. I mean, some of you will remember last year there was additional language adopted to make it clear that the agencies are not supposed to do anything twice. They're not supposed to do all of the investigation for environmental review and then do it again for the permitting process. They're supposed to do those together. And I think the agencies are doing that and are doing what they can to avoid that duplication, and I think the statute already addresses that. If there is duplication, that's something that I hope that those process improvement efforts will address, because it really shouldn't be occurring, and I think the legislature has already made that clear. I don't mean to suggest that the process is perfect, because it's not. I mean, there are significant problems with the environmental review process, and I'll finish just by addressing those really, really quickly. I mentioned mitigation and how important that is to the whole process. We don't have a consistent procedure for assuring that those mitigation measures actually get done, or measuring whether or not they're effective. And that's something that I think should be added to the process. We need to learn from these environmental assessment worksheets so that if there's a mitigation measure that's particularly effective, that we get that adopted more often. If there's something that's being adopted as a mitigation measure that's not particularly effective, let's not do it again. That we need to make these more learning documents than they are currently. We have a serious problem with capacity. I think the state agencies have suffered the budget cuts. It's harder for them to get this stuff done. But for those 99 local governments that do these environmental reviews each year, I think that was the number that the PCA came up with, there's a wide variety in the capacity of those local governments to deal with these issues. I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but sometimes the most serious problems with respect to delay and from the side of effectiveness too come when there simply isn't enough capacity in the responsible government unit to perform the functions that have been assigned by the law. That's a serious problem. It's exacerbated then in those cases where there's actually a conflict of interest, where the agency that's the responsible government unit is for environmental review and permitting is also the agency or unit of government that's responsible for promoting the particular industry. That's a problem in some parts of state government. It's often an issue in local government where the need to expand the property tax base and expand property tax revenue competes with perhaps the regulatory role that the state provides. And it is in some of those cases where we get some of the more serious problems. I will say from our experience that the cases where the delays or the process takes the longest usually have a few characteristics, and we think the legislative auditor will corroborate this. We don't know, but we suspect that they'll find that the cases that take the longest, number one, they're cases where there's a federal overlay, where there's a joint federal-state environmental impact statement. Those take a long time because of the federal process. when there's lots of public interest in a project because of the hearing requirements and the comment process that goes through, when there are delays in getting information from the project proposer, and the U.S. Steel was very candid in saying that some of the problems they had with the KTAC EIS were because they had difficulty getting the necessary information back to the responsible government unit during the process. And then finally, and this is something that we'll freely acknowledge, these cases take longer when the federal rules change in the middle. I think you heard from a couple of people who had that experience where they went through the process, the rules changed at the federal level, and they had to either start over or redo a lot of what they're doing. Those do expand the length of the process, and that's when that happens, I think that's difficult, but it's something that we simply have to address as part of the law. It's important to keep straight that the concerns be about the environmental process, review process and the permitting process, and not be about downgrading our environmental protections. I think that's something that everybody has said is their position. I hope that's something that the committee will continue to adhere to as a principle going forward.
Thank you,
Mr.
Strand.
With that, I'll stand for any question.
We have a question from Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Strand. Since you just testified that you're against piecemeal approaches, thus you would support a combination of and consolidation of regulatory authority down to one agency for simplification. How would you propose doing this for water issues and permitting?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I didn't say that I support the merger of agencies. I think that sometimes is the most problematic way of doing it. But, I mean, there are things that are happening now which I think are terrific to really help that process. I mean, there is a common water permit application that goes to several agencies that have responsibility over water so that the same information doesn't have to be gathered twice, I think that, or three or four times. I think that's important. The Environmental Permit Coordinating Act that I referred to, where it gives the assignment to the Employment and Economic Development Department to notify any agency that has to ask them whether they have an interest in a project, with an affirmative obligation on the part of those agencies to say they do, or otherwise they're closed out of the process. I think that's a tough consequence, but I think that's something that makes some sense to make sure that there aren't any new regulatory requirements that come in late in the process. So I think there's a lot of things that can be done within certainly the state process to make sure that we don't have those duplications that can sometimes occur. Merging agencies raises, again, a whole host of other issues and costs that that may overwhelm some of the benefits that you can get from that sort of better coordination.
Thank you, Mr. Do you have a follow-up, Representative Klum? Representative Beard has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is going to be first just an observation and then a question that goes beyond probably the scope of this bill, but deals with the whole business of how we let big people do big things in this state that move the ball forward, that create a lot of jobs. Your organization is notorious not so much for playing in the process or the agency side of things, but for playing in the courts, pursuing to stop things and to gum up the works and kind of committing a war of attrition on really big projects. I'm pleased to see your testimony here and your endorsement of the process as it exists at the moment, although I think we would differ as to how efficient that is. I think your side would probably agree that there's copious amounts of time for public comment, and I just heard you comment that that's important so that the process actually runs its course, citizens are heard, mitigation is put in place, and so on. We come to the end of the first quarter of this game. Now we've got the process run, permits issued or in transit or something like that, and now the game changes to a different arena entirely, and that's the judiciary. That's where your organization is most notorious for playing. Is there anything we can do in legislation, Mr. Strand, that would actually let the process do its business, allow companies and people that want to actually invest in this state and create wealth and prosperity to have a certain outcome without then having to employ legions of lawyers and go plead their case in front of the judiciary, which has been completely disengaged in this process all along? How does that fit into the picture? How does that make Minnesota a better place?
Mr. Chairman, let me address that in a couple of ways. First of all, citizen suit provisions have been part of our environmental laws for 40 years. They're a basic part of the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, and it's based on the idea that if an agency does not perform its legal obligation, that there be an opportunity to seek review in the courts. anything that our agencies do at the state level and anything that local government does is subject to judicial review. People always have the option of challenging those decisions in court. It's kind of interesting when you add up the number of cases that have gotten to the courts that involve the environmental review process. It's really just a handful. We've had the law on the books for nearly 40 years, and there have been far fewer than 40 cases that have made it to the Court of Appeals. It's not something that happens very often. It's something that we take very seriously. I mean, we don't initiate any litigation at our shop until it goes through a fairly rigorous process. We have to have we have a set of criteria that we take a look at. We can't initiate a lawsuit from the staff perspective without getting approval of our legal committee. And I think the cases that MCA has brought over the years have had a substantive basis most of the time. They haven't won all the cases, but I think that there has been a crucial statewide legal issue involved in nearly every one of those cases that it really did require the courts to resolve. So, I defend that record. I don't think we've abused the judicial process. I think we've used the remedies that the Congress and the state legislature have provided to make sure that what the agencies do, what local government does, is consistent with the law.
Follow up, Representative.
Just a comment as we move ahead, because I know we're getting outside the scope of this bill, which is process and regulatory reform, which is statutory. But I can think of several instances where this agent or this NGO, I might point out, it's not a government association; it's volunteers and outside the scope of government. But we have given them a door, a window to come into the process and use levers and the input and so on is not a discussion here. We're in the process with public comment and the process, the permits and the applications are moving through the public process. That's where the citizens are engaged. It's once we're out of here and we've got an agreement, for instance, on the new Stillwater Bridge, and all of a sudden one of these NGOs shows up and derails the entire process. Or will we almost lose the new mining technology to the state of Indiana because they can move the whole thing through in 9 months without the threat of lawsuits hanging over their heads like it is here. Or I could go on and on. Perhaps we ought to consider at some point how we reform the legal process so that whenever somebody wants to site a new power plant, for instance, the Lord knows that's not happening in this state for a long time to come. When we're talking about a 7-year permitting process, we're realizing that half of that is actually tied up in the courts. Does that actually serve the public well? Does that actually drive down costs and make us more effective and more competitive? These are, in a sense, rhetorical questions at the moment. But as we move ahead with this bill, I want you to understand that the process that we're dealing with here with the agencies is only half of the problem that we're dealing with. The other half lies with people we allow to come in from the outside and gum up the works and drive up the cost, oftentimes with no change in the outcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Beard. I believe Representative Drazkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, I think, covered the waterfront pretty well. I would just add to that maybe a quick comment. We see the same things in agriculture with feedlots. We heard yesterday from some presenters around the areas of ethanol facilities. And, Mr. Strand, it's happening again and again. It's unfortunate, and it seems that your organization and some others, too, and according to your testimony, place trust and encourage us to trust and support the current permitting process that exists in government. And there's a full trust in government until you don't get the outcome you want. And that's unfortunate.
Would you care to respond, Mr. Strand?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the only response I have is, first of all, the vast majority of circumstances where we're involved in a particular case, the issue is resolved in the administrative process, and we don't go to court. It's an unusual case where we use the litigation options, and when we do that, it's because we believe that there's been a misinterpretation or misapplication of either the federal or state law that we think the courts need to remedy, and I think that's an important part of all of our laws. I think it would be a mistake to insulate either state agencies or local units of government from judicial review. I think that's an essential part of the set of rights that the public has to challenge government decisions. Certainly our approach is to work with the agencies as best we can, but if there are situations where we cannot reach a resolution, we will consider using the rights that all citizens have to pursue a remedy in the courts.
Thank you, Mr. Strand. I believe Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Strand. I'm trying to sort this out and bring it back to the science. You know, mm-hmm. we want to have good decisions looking at the best available information that's current to be applied to decision making. That's what I kind of think is going on here. And after the last two questions, I think you or your organization probably has a lot of experience looking at the documents and has gone over these cases over and over, whether it's in the court system or elsewhere. And I hear the references to agencies, and I hear discussion about timelines. I'm trying to sort out, you know, we've had visuals or ideas of visuals of stacks of paper, of reports. Who generates that paper? Are those consultants that are hired by the proposer? Are those written by agency employees? Are they directed by agencies? Is it the best available information that's being brought forward by the proposer to build these stacks of paper, whatever the timeline? I've gotten some impression that this is all generated by a state employee living in a cubicle who's just mm-hmm. trying to stop a project or trying not to understand a project. But mm-hmm. it seems to me there's consultants and contractors and the private sector and the proposer, and it's all together, isn't it? Or who generates the paper?
Well, Mr. Chairman, our representative, in the large cases where there's a lot of scientific investigation, where there are a lot of reports created, I mean, generally the reports are prepared by consultants. Sometimes they're hired by the project proposer. Sometimes they're hired by the agency or the responsible government unit. There is a kind of a continual, during the, say, an EIS process, there's a fairly continual interrelationship between the government employees, the project proposer, and the consultants. It's a kind of an ongoing iterative process where different issues get addressed. And so if you take, a fairly complicated question about, say, groundwater, hydrogeology, typically the agencies are going to have some expertise in-house if it's, say, the DNR on that particular issue, but they may need to go outside to other consultants who can do more extensive work. And the law allows for that. It has the project proposer pay for it. And in the really most difficult projects, that's what happens. So it's not a state employee in a cubicle. It's state employees, you know, maybe in cubicles, but they're working with consultants who are outside of the process, who can bring hopefully an objective scientific, you know, point of view to these questions. And then working with the project proposer as well, who also obviously has a stake in it and may bring some of their own input. There's no question that in some of the cases, and again, it's the toughest, most complicated cases where this happens, I mean, there will be disagreements. There will be scientific disagreements on particular issues that have to be sorted out, and that does take a certain amount of time. I think that's time well spent when that happens, because I think when there's a genuine discussion about the science of a particular environmental issue or the engineering and the technology of the particular means that are being offered to address that environmental issue, that's exactly what we want our agencies to be doing. It's exactly what we want consultants and proposers to be doing. And when they work together closely, that's when the process is at its best.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Strand, so in your experience, this isn't an issue of quality, then, where we are getting into the process right now the best available science or different views of the science, but wherever the data is coming from, it is quality information that's leading to the best available decisions. Someone eventually has to make a decision, but the decisions are not faltering because of quality of data. Is that?
Well, let me just, Mr. Chairman, let me just draw one distinction. I mean, I think in the larger cases, the EIS cases, where the RGU, the Responsible Government Unit, is one of our state agencies, I think the quality has generally been, pretty high. A lot of times where there are disputes, it's about the application of the law. You know, it's a legal dispute, which leads to a different set of discussions. But there usually is a pretty good scientific dialogue. I mean, sometimes we will raise a concern that an issue isn't being addressed that way, that an issue is being dropped, and it's not being addressed by the scientists the way it should be. And we'll provide that input to the agency, and we hope that they'll respond. I have to say that there are some situations, again, where some of the, I think particularly with some of the local governments that don't have the staff available to do this kind of stuff, that sometimes the quality of the work that's done in some EAWs isn't as high I'd be willing to say that. I don't think that's, I don't want to generalize, but I've certainly have seen examples like that where the work hasn't been as good. But that's just an observation based on the cases that kind of come through our doors.
One more follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence on this. Just maybe a final comment. I would think that our goal here would be, whatever the process is that we try to achieve the highest quality we can, and that at some, and you have to have some type of third party or some type of evaluator to make a decision that's a decision that can stand based on its merits and the quality. And I would hope that as this bill moves forward, that we think about the quality factor, because I'm not sure that that's in there. I see a lot of process and timing, but I would think that Minnesotans would want to make sure that we're getting the best available science, that we have impartial decision makers that can make a decision so that maybe it doesn't end up in the court system, and that we base that on the skills of the folks who are involved in this and the people who are making those decisions on the best available information that they have at the time.
Mr. Chairman, I'd agree with all of that. The only thing I'd add is that when mitigation measures are decided on by those agencies, that we make sure that they happen and that they're effective.
Thank you, Mr. Strand. We've allowed an inordinate amount of time for your presentation this morning, and I think it's because your group in particular is the focus of a great deal of attention. You pointed out earlier that there are very few cases that actually end up in the courts, but the threat of litigation that is utilized by your organization is applied very liberally, from my observation, and this is a concern of this committee and many of the members on it. So we will address this in future endeavors, and I thank you for your presentation this morning. We'll go on, please. Gwen Myers from the League of Women Voters. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Gwen Myers. I'm a volunteer lobbyist with the League of Women Voters. All of you have taken part in our candidate forums, I'm sure, and know that we are not an environmental organization. We are a good government organization. But we define good government very broadly. Along with protecting the rights of every citizen to vote, we support the right of those citizens to know what their government is doing and to participate in government decisions at all levels. In other words, transparency and citizen participation are top priorities. This is time-consuming sometimes, we know that, but in the end, better decisions are made, better results are achieved. At least that's the theory of a democracy. Protecting the environment is among the government's most important responsibilities. The health and happiness of all of us today is at stake. But more important, perhaps, the health and happiness of our children and our grandchildren are in our hands as we make decisions about the environment today. The League has a number of concerns about the language in House File 1, but to pick just one of these, the section that would allow a project proposer to prepare the draft EIS rather than the responsible government unit is truly remarkable. This would not only put the proposer in charge of his own EIS, giving us a fox and hen house problem, but it takes the responsible unit of government out of the initial process. This will make the underlying information and analyses that are developed in this initial process unavailable to the public, which clearly violates the transparency standard. This is just not acceptable. The League believes the public has a right to know whether the proposal is a million-gallon manure lagoon just down the road, a tire-burning plant in a bucolic landscape, or a used car lot in the middle of town. The public has a right to know and to take part in the decision-making process, and in fact, to go to court if they believe there are problems. We hope you will keep the citizens in mind as you review House File 1 and the other proposals that will surely come your way to modify environmental review requirements and to streamline the permitting process. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Ms. Myers. Are there any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, we'll move along. Next on the list is Bobby King from the Land Stewardship Project. Are you? I do not see that testifier in the room. We'll move on to Tom Osteris and Gordon Gray from Excelsior Energy. If you would introduce yourselves for the record, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Osteris. I'm counsel to Excelsior Energy, and Gordy Gray is one of our executives who's been responsible largely for our permitting effort. And I promise to keep this brief. I just have a couple of observations. For those who aren't aware, the Mesaba project is a large baseload power plant located in northeastern Minnesota. And we've been through the entire formal EIS process. We did both the joint state and federal EIS. Much like you heard from U.S. Steel yesterday, our experience mirrors theirs quite a bit. And I won't repeat the comments that they made, but I agreed wholeheartedly with their observations and their lessons learned. Our process started in June of 2006 and concluded really in the spring of last year. And it concluded with the Public Utilities Commission issuing permits, site permits, for a new large baseload power plant in northeastern Minnesota. The process really went as we expected. It was very time-consuming and complex. The only issue that I'd like to raise for the committee's attention is something that's unique to power plant siting, and that is under the Power Plant Siting Act, for a large baseload plant, there's a requirement that the proposer make two alternative sites available, and then the Public Utilities Commission throughout the process has to select one of the two sites. And we went through that process, and we did that and complied with all the rules. But it was very time-consuming and costly, and I'm not exactly sure whether the benefits exceed the costs in that exercise, and I'm not recommending any change. I just wanted to bring it to the committee's attention that the next time someone goes to site a large baseload plant, there is a requirement that they propose alternative sites, and that's something that really makes the process more complicated than it would otherwise be. The other consequence of the requirement to propose two sites is that the agencies that are issuing ultimately the air permit or the water permit, you know, are not able to focus really until the siting decision is made. They're not really able to focus on the actual final air and water permits. And I was very gratified to hear Mr. Strand say earlier that they agree that duplication is something that's to be avoided, because what we're facing, similar to what we heard from U.S. Steel, I think, is now we've gone through this entire EIS process over 4 years, and we're only now at the point where the agencies can start proceeding with our air and water permits. And what we hope doesn't happen is that there's a whole other set of contested case proceedings in the context of the air and water permits when all of those issues were covered at length and very diligently in the earlier EIS process. So I'm just bringing that to the committee's attention. I don't have any particular recommendation. In closing, I would say that we support House File 1 as much as anything, because it highlights again that permitting on these large projects should be a priority for the state agencies, and we think that's a good message to be sending. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Osteris. Mr. Gray, would you have any comments to add? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, my name is Gordy Gray. I'm Vice President of Development, but as Tom mentioned, spent most of the last 4.5 years working on the environmental review and permitting process for the Mesaba project. And I think Tom pretty much covered everything that we have to say, and but I'm available for questions if there's specific questions about the process.
Excellent, thank you. Does the committee have any questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, we will thank you for your presentation. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't catch you, Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's my bad eye on the left side, and so it's a little hard for me to catch you.
Just a couple questions to the testifiers, if they would be willing. Has Excelsior Energy been given any special exemptions in law?
The Mesaba project was exempt from the certificate of need requirements under state law.
If I could ask a couple follow-up questions.
Sure, go ahead.
Does that include special eminent domain language?
The enabling statute for innovative energy projects does include a grant of eminent domain rights for innovative energy projects.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's a bit unusual for a private company that would be a an independent power producer, not a utility-owned facility. If I may ask another, has Mesaba received any special sources of funding from maybe not typical sources for resources?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the Mesaba project was selected in competitive solicitations for significant federal funding from the Department of Energy under their Clean Coal Power Initiative. And then under state law, this project was made eligible for funding from a renewable development fund, and the project received prior support from the Iron Range Resources Board. And I would just add that, you know, notwithstanding the exemption that I mentioned a minute ago from the certificate of need, it's been roughly 5 years of intensive engineering work and preparation to proceed and to move the permits forward as much as we have to date. Thank you.
Final question, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Go ahead.
Is there a utility that wants to purchase this power?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I'm not sure what you mean by this power. I mean, the Mesaba project was designed to provide baseload resources for the state. What we're trying to do is tee up an option for future baseload resources for the state. If none of the utilities ever need baseload resources again, then the project won't get built.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that if we're going to continue to talk about this project, maybe have the utilities come down and ask them if they see a need for it or if it's in their long-range resource plans, but maybe that's a discussion for another day. So
I believe so. Thank you, Representative Falk. I will try not to ignore you in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only concluding comment is that, you know, the permitting process on a large baseload plan, as everybody is aware, is very difficult and complicated. So, you know, one response to the question of is the power needed, at some point there's going to be a need for new incremental baseload capacity. And I, in my mind, tend to think of it as if you could actually get through the permitting process, then suddenly this resource becomes a important option for the state to have up and ready to go. You don't have to go through the 7 years and tens of millions of dollars.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson, for your testimony about the need for future baseload power. Anybody else? Is the other testifier to speak yet, or you're done?
No, we're finished. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yep. Appreciate your testimony. Would the next testifiers please come forward? Mr. Peterson from the Farmers Union, are you here? Thank you. As he comes forward, Mr. Gary Botzik is in the audience somewhere. I can't believe you're hiding. No, you're up there. Okay. All right. If you'd be ready. Mr. Peterson, if you could keep it short and sweet and get to the gist of what you like or dislike about House File 1, and then we'll be ready to rock and roll.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I'm Director of Government Relations with the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I will be very brief. There's a couple of pieces in the bill that in discussing with our members that they have concerns about. One is in Section 4, and that is the part that where the state has the authority to set the higher standards in the federal government, and then changing that and kind of looking to see how that interacts. We've always supported allowing the state to do that and not have to to make it a little more complicated to go into reasons with the federal government for that need. I'm kind of looking at that and seeing how that's going to impact going forward. Our other concern is with Section 7, as Ms. Palmer stated, having the project proposer preparing and being responsible for drafting their own EISs. I think the concern there is, you know, how average citizen would interact with a project if Joe's Widget Factory comes into Pine City or something where I live. Right now, with the RGU being involved at the first level, as I understand it, it's easier for people to interact. And so if a private proposer is doing that, I'm not sure how that's going to play out going forward. And again, I come at this as a little different, as you know, our members have issues with permits and environmental review sometimes, but a lot of times they're on the opposite side of environmental review and EISs and the issues that we're dealing with here. You know, for, I'll just be really blunt. We have a 50 cow dairy, and you know, I've been there my whole life and everything, and then somebody's going to move a much larger facility in next to me, and then the concerns are there sometimes, and this is where opportunities arise for, conflicts and differences. And so that's where a lot of this comes from. And a lot of people just want to make sure their area is going to be safe and clean. And in a general, a lot of the projects move forward very good, and there is no conflict. I see a lot of good projects, whether it's a feedlot or an ethanol plant or whatever the project is, but a lot of times they are in rural areas. And so that gives me the last thing that we have the most concern with is Section 6, and that is the decision on the need from the EIS, the chance for local citizens to have a say in their communities on a project in district court instead of it moving it to the Court of Appeals. I feel really strongly about that after talking to a lot of our members. I know, understand that it could end up in the Court of Appeals and it's redundant, a lot of people have told me, but the fact that I can have my day in court in Thief River Falls if I'm a citizen and concerned about a project and not have to drive to St. Paul is a big issue for a lot of people. Or if, wherever I live, having the attorneys come out and have the case there first and hear the issues there first in your local area where the project's proposed, I think is a very is well supported by a lot of the real people I've talked to. Thank you, and I look forward to it.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Next is Mr. Botzik, and I understand, Mr. King from Land Stewardship are going to come together. If we could get your guys' testimony, that'd be great, because then we're going to move into the bill, and we're absolutely going to finish this bill and be done by 10 o'clock, and I want to be able to have testimony from the members here about the bill. Mr. King, welcome. Good to see you, and thanks for being accommodating, both of you, on changing your schedule from yesterday and today. Give us a short synopsis of your thoughts on House File 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Bobby King from the Land Stewardship Project. We're a membership organization that works on promoting a family farm-based system of agriculture. The legislative auditor pointed out yesterday that the environmental review and process involves more than just the person seeking a permit and the agency, that the public is a part of the process and designed to be part of the process for good reason, and that's LSP's involvement, Land Stewardship Project's involvement in environmental review has been through our members who have become involved in the process because they're concerned about a large development. In our situation, it's usually been a large animal confinement that's proposed near them. So these folks are farmers and rural people who understand and know farming and want business development in their community, but they don't want it at the expense of their water or air, especially groundwater, is a very big issue because that's, in rural Minnesota, I think folks know they're drinking water. Also, these projects, less than 100 environmental review cases happen a year. They're the largest of the large projects, and they have the potential to impact people's community for decades. So people should have the opportunity for meaningful say, and environmental review is in many cases that the only opportunity for folks to do that. The last thing I want to say in general before going through a couple pieces in the bill is that businesses talked about how daunting it is, and I'm sure that's true. It's also very daunting for citizens. Imagine farming, raising kids, and on your off time trying to read an environmental review and understand it, and then try to incorporate your comments into that process. But just one example comes to mind. A large turkey barn was proposed in Goodhue County that neighboring farmers were concerned about because they'd seen the area flood over the years. And the analysis, the computer analysis was showing it was fine, but their real world experience was it's not fine. That area floods. As a result, that project was moved to a better location. On the bill in particular, I think our concerns would be first on the goal. We heard from the PCA that they often and usually meet this goal, but there's going to be some cases we feel where 150 days is legitimately not realizable, especially when an EAW goes to an EIS. So putting in statute a number that sometimes can't legitimately be realized is we think, bad policy. And also, some of the timeline is beyond the agency's control. If the proposer's not getting the information in a timely.
Is there anything else, Mr. King, in the bill that you'd like to address specifically before Mr. Botzek starts?
The subdivision one on obtaining a permit, allowing a proposer to build before the permit's been issued, environmental review has been done. That's the way I understand this provision. That kind of that flies against the purpose of environmental review, which is to try to discover how a project can be done better. So if environmental review discovers something that could be mitigated through a different build, but the project's already on its way, it makes incorporating what's found very difficult, and it may be impossible.
Is there one more point you'd like to make, Mr. King?
Yeah, I'd reiterate what Mr. Peterson said about the courts. We feel the same way. And then lastly, having to justify wanting to have strong protections in Minnesota against the federal standards, we feel is not a good idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. Mr. Botzek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary Botzek, representing the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. My Minnesota Conservation Federation is a member of the MEP as the League of Women Voters. LSP, Bobby just spoke, MCAA, and over 75 additional organizations, environmental and conservations, the conservationist groups. We try to promote good environment, and we have some concerns about this legislation as well. I have one handout, Mr. Chairman, if the pages could take it. We represent close to 500,000 people in Minnesota. We are committed to protecting and preserving Minnesota's great outdoors so that it can be passed on to our kids and our grandkids. Nothing new there. We've heard a lot of good testimony in the last couple days, and I'm happy that I stayed for all 3 days, Mr. Chairman, to be educated. But we need more information on the table. We need to hear from the EQB, who runs this program. We haven't heard from them and their statistics. We did hear from the Legislative Audit Commission and their report that's forthcoming. I think you should wait for that. One of the things that I follow as I subscribe to some emails, I get the fines issued by the Department of Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Some of the permits that we've issued out there after good, strong environmental review are still violating the law. They're polluting, if you will, beyond their permits. Some of these fines are substantial. $5,000 here, $10,000 there, $50,000. I think you've all seen them in the paper. That's after a good environmental review. And we're talking about relaxing that or speeding that up. We're just asking for more opportunities to misplay themselves. And that I understand you need to do this and are moving forward with this, but be cautious as you go forward. And I know you talked, Mr. Chairman, about additional the legislation forthcoming, so maybe we can address it then as there. But we need to be careful a little bit, because some of these projects, look at the multi-housing project that was just proposed on Lake Minnetonka. You think that doesn't deserve extreme severe environmental review? Silt fencing that Senator Representative Beard talked about, that's a minor thing, but what happens if we have a flash flood or a quick thaw and all of a sudden we kill 50,000 or 500,000 fish in a stream that a silt fence was designed, frozen or not? You know, we have to be a little careful on this. Let's err on the side of the environment. And Minnesota Environmental Partnership is not anti-business. In fact, we're pro-business, as we've testified on solar and wind and other projects. We can do both in Minnesota. We have a strong, rich tradition. As this poll points out, this was done in November after the election, 80% of the Minnesotans that were polled, and these are voters, registered voters, by a very reputable firm, Republican-Democrat firm, said 81% support retaining the strong environmental standards that we have in Minnesota to protect our water, our soils, and our air. Let's not forget that. We talked about the legacy amendment the other day, 64%. This is even stronger than that. The most recent referendum was the legacy, and that's strong, 64%. We got more votes for that day than President Obama got in Minnesota, which is something you can hang your hat on. So. And we've held there, or Obama's kind of going like this. We're still there. And so we want to...
Thank you for reminding us about that.
For my friends on both sides of the aisle here. But yes. We need to be careful. That's all we're asking, Mr. Chairman. And we'll hold my comments for the bill after it's been presented.
Thank you, Mr. Botzek. Next, Representative Beard.
I got the look. Never mind.
Thank you. thank you, Mr. Botzek. Mr. King, both of you made good comments that are very important, and thank you for coming forward. Next, we're going to hear from some county engineers up in northwestern Minnesota. If the four of you want to come, the pages will help slide some chairs. Engineers, if you could be real short and sweet and not duplicate what each one of you has to say. I want to put it into perspective. If either one of you, the one that's driven the longest and farthest, could just tell us how many miles and how many hours it took to come, then we're all going to appreciate your very short testimony and know how important your words are. But whoever drove the farthest, if you could tell us how many hours without breaking the law and how many miles you drove. And you need to introduce yourself and which county you're the engineer for.
All right.
Just who you represent.
All right. Thank you, Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk before you tonight. Today. My name is Lon Owney. I'm Marshall County engineer. I did not drive the furthest of the four of us here. He's next to me. But the biggest thing we want to point out is we're not against the regulations. We like the environment as much as everybody else. But what we're dealing with is much smaller projects than some of the other people that you've had testify before you. But our process is taking longer, so we are not able to get our projects completed in timely manners to meet the needs of our residents. And we have a couple of examples here that they'll explain to you. But the biggest thing that we want to do is try to point out to you that these delays that we're seeing are taking projects that are very simple in northwestern Minnesota, causing them to drag out 3, 4, sometimes 5 years so that the residents aren't able to travel on a safe road. They're not able to get the proper drainage from their fields to get their crops out, things of that nature, or even utilize the fields that they have out there. And what we'd like to see happening is the streamlining of the process for projects that we deal with so that we're able to get our projects completed. And I'll close out with that and pass it on to Brian for his explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I actually did the driving because we carpooled, so I drove the farthest.
If you could identify yourself for the records and tell us how many miles.
Brian Kettering, Roseau County engineer, and approximately 400 miles.
Thank you. Go ahead with your testimony.
When we left, it was 33 below zero.
We probably didn't want to hear that. Yeah. I've heard it's coming our way. It was 33. Oh, my. Go ahead.
I am here as the drainage authority for Roseau County. We have 900 miles of ditches in Roseau County, which is absolutely imperative to our agricultural community. I think you have a map in front of you which shows that these ditches have to coexist with state-owned property and the environment. And so what this bill does for us is it keeps the regulatory people at the table. We have a situation where we're 8 years out from receiving a permit, and truthfully, it just gets lost. And so what this does is it keeps everyone at the table. We know we have to coexist. We, too, are environmental advocates. Why else would we be in northern Minnesota? And so for what this bill does for us is it keeps everyone to the table. We can come to a solution at the end of the day that works for absolutely everyone. So
thank you, Mr. Kettering. And next, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kelly Bankson, Kitson County Highway Department. It's about 400 miles and 8 hours. Kitson County is in the top 10 in ag production. Tons of annually planted ag crops in the state of Minnesota when you look at how the counties rank. I believe Marshall County also is in the top 10. It's our job to deliver projects to help our constituents or taxpayers get their crops from farm to market. And as Lon mentioned, our projects really are not huge projects, you know, typically less than $1 million and typically no more than $2 million. We have seen our projects delayed more often here in the last 5 years, and we're happy to support this bill to streamline our permitting processes that we have to go through. Generally, we have to obtain about 9 permits, and it seems like most of them happen without too much problem. However, there's a couple of agencies that are typically difficult to deal with, and we're hopeful that your act here to help the DNR and the MPCA get their streamlining of their permits would be gratefully approved. One thing I'd like to mention is that the MCEA did come after our joint ditch authority. We cleaned out a legal ditch in 2006. It was a $12,000 project. And we didn't lower any culverts. We removed brush and beaver dams is all we did. And the MCEA came after us with a lawsuit, and we spent $250,000 fighting it. So it was a very disappointing ordeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bankston. Sorry. Mr. Flagan, if you could identify yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Flagan. I'm with Pennington County, county engineer. And I guess we're all just here to, you know, just to make note that there's bureaucratic barriers to delivering projects that extends beyond the interactions of the DNR and MPCA. And the county engineers and Association of Minnesota Counties are therefore working to address those process-related issues. So it's very likely that you'll continue to see further bills coming up throughout the session that deals with these issues. They're focusing on issues related to water permitting, state historical preservation office decision timelines. So we hope that this committee will support the Transportation Committee and Representative Fabian in those efforts. Again, thank you, and we just appreciate the chance to be in front of you today.
Thank you, Mr. Flagan, and all four of you for your commitment and willingness to come down and share your experiences. It's a little frustrating to hear a $12,000 removal of some beaver dams added to the taxpayers' $200,000+ expense there. That's frustrating, and I think it shows the need that we all need to work together better to get the end result. Thank you for your testimony. Next, Representative Fabian, if you want to come forward, and you can move your bill when you get to the testifying table. Representative Fabian, I believe you want to move your bill, and it looks like it's going to go to civil law. If you want to make a motion to that effect, that'd be great.
Move that we move House File 1.
And send it on to civil law.
Send it on to civil law.
Thank you. Go ahead with your testimony, Representative Fabian. I'm going to say the same thing to you we said to everybody else. Short and sweet, and let's get to the point because there's going to be members that want to have discussion. Representative Fabian, the one thing I'm wondering if you want to move the A9 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like to discuss, and then why don't you go ahead and do that, and then I believe there's a second thing we'll need to discuss after that.
All right, I move that we move the A9 amendment to the bill.
Members, Representative Fabian has moved the A9 amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment's on. Representative Fabian, if I'm not mistaken, we had a snafu, and I apologize to members. I think it would just been a mix-up between staff and the partisan and nonpartisan staff, and it certainly was not meant by us to shortchange the process, but I believe there's a few words that MPCA had asked to have changed, and so I'm wondering if Mr. Eloff asked to have changed, and so I'm wondering if Mr. Eloff from our nonpartisan staff could explain those changes and then allow time for both sides of the aisle to understand it and question it. Mr. Eloff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little thrown off because what we kind of really need to do is amend the A9 amendment, which we just adopted. And let me get the words out.
Mr. Eloff, maybe I didn't explain that well. That's what I would like you to do. We just adopted the A9, and there are a few word changes in A9 that MPCA had been working with you over the last 36 hours. And I would like you to explain those proposed words and then allow both sides to fully understand them. I think they're non-controversial, but I want you to be able to explain them and be sure we all understand them, not only the people at the table, but the people in the audience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me get the words out first and then the explanation. On the A9 amendment, on page 2, line 13, after the word A, insert, quote, change, addition, or extension to an existing disposal, unquote. And page 2, line 14, the very next line, after the word discharging, insert, quote, additional or increased, unquote. Let me explain a little about what these changes mean. If you look at the amendment, you'll note that on the first page, on line 5, there's paragraph B that goes down almost to the end of the page. That language refers to essentially this amendment is allowing some projects at their own risk to begin construction of certain kinds of waste of water treatment projects prior to receiving a permit. And the those lines I just cited on the first page of the amendment pertain to new projects. Beginning at the bottom of the page, there's essentially the same language. You'll notice the same six clauses on the top of page 3. That second part refers to additions or extensions of existing projects. And the actual language changes that I just read to lines 213 and 214 are to reflect that these refer to changes, additions, or extensions of a project.
Thank you, Mr. Elop. Do we need any further clarification? Thank you. Representative Fabian, do you want to move what Mr. Elop just said as an oral amendment to the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I so move.
Okay. Discussion? All those in favor of the oral amendment as Mr. Elop has read, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, Representative Fabian, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today. This bill, HF1, for me, is a bill. It's about streamlining government. It's about reducing timelines. It's about creating jobs. It's about taking burdens off of local governments. It's about lifting some of the heavy weights off of our businesses that are trying to grow and expand and start here in the state of Minnesota. It's about being responsible, and it's about being responsive, and all the while reducing the tax burden possibly at our local governments and also protecting our environment. It's very, very important to us. We all live here in Minnesota, and I think that's important for us to understand that nobody wants to see our environment deteriorate. I've raised my children in Roseau. The guys who came down here to testify, they've done that. You've all done the same thing yourselves. The highlights of the bill for me center around the goals. We talked about the goals of 150 days. They are goals. We've had some discussions about that. One of the things that's the strength of the bill is the fact that through these goals, through the data gathering processes, we should be able to kind of come to some conclusions about why some projects take longer and why some take less time. And through that process, we should be able to come up with more streamlining so that we can identify where the problems are. We also like the 30-day to be able to approve the EIS. Again, we think that that's a goal. We understand that some of them can take longer, and we're willing to work with that through the departments. The repeal process on the water permits, where they're talking about construction before the permit, there again, that's a risk that the proposer takes. You're not allowed to discharge. None of the rules are being violated in terms of polluting our environment or anything like that. We also like the fact that the proposer is going to be able to work more closely with the people who are preparing the EIS. We think that that's going to speed up the process. It's going to allow for better communications between the proposer and the gathering of the data. And then, of course, the part in there where it talks about changing some standards to meet the federal standards. We think that that's going to make us more competitive. In Northwest Minnesota, we compete a lot against North Dakota, west of the Red River. And we'd like to see Minnesota stay and become more competitive in the future. With that, If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those as best I can.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Questions for Representative Fabian? Thank you, Representative Fabian. You want to renew your motion to... I'm sorry, Representative Falk.
You got a bad eye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, if I may. Representative Fabian, I'd like to get a little more information, if you would be willing to share, about Section 6 and what that means for citizens living in rural parts of the state. Where would they have to travel if they're supposed to testify or want to offer comments or just observe a process if this stage is set in a court of appeals versus a district court? Can you explain to me where rural people are going to have to travel to at least have access to that equal branch of government?
Representative Fabian, or if the new testifier could identify yourself and answer Representative Falk's question. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Thaddeus Lightfoot. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm an environmental lawyer with the Environmental Law Group in Minneapolis, and I'm also an adjunct professor of environmental law at the William Mitchell College of Law. Mr. Chair, Representative, it's important to understand that in environmental review cases, there is no testimony in the justice system. There is no testimony before the trial court or in the Court of Appeals. The important public input portion in environmental review cases comes before the agency in the public comment period and in public hearings on the environmental review documents. Once the agency closes the administrative record is closed, and the agency takes no testimony, and then the district court relies upon that administrative record that the agency has established to determine whether or not the environmental review document is adequate, complies with the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. The rationale for the change in Section 6 is that in that context, the District Court and the Court of Appeals do exactly the same thing. They review the same administrative record under the same standard of review, an arbitrary and capricious standard that is deferential to the Minnesota or to the responsible governmental unit. And the difficulty is, at least in the last case I had that went to the Court of Appeals, an action brought by the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy against the Department of Natural Resources and a project proposer, SR Steel Minnesota, that I represented. We spent a year and a half in the district court looking, while the district court resolved the issue on the legal grounds, on an administrative record, before we got to the Court of Appeals, that then looked at the same administrative record and addressed the exact same legal issues. That's the rationale for the proposed change.
Mr. Lightfoot, could you answer his question as to where they would go?
They would go to the Court of Appeals, Mr. Chair, Representative, and the Court of Appeals would hold the hearing either in St. Paul, or the Court of Appeals does hold regional hearings, and there is an ability for counsel in the cases to request that the Court of Appeals hold hearings in outstate Minnesota, not necessarily in St. Paul. But the action would be exclusively in the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Falk?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to sit and think about this for a moment.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Yes. Thank you. Representative Fabian, you said, and I believe you.
Representative Wagenius, maybe you just need to pull the mic in a little better. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, you said nobody wants to see anything bad happen to the environment. And I appreciated those words. I want to look with you at Section 4 of this proposed bill. There's a standard on page 4, and this is talking about air quality. But the same is going to apply to water, but let's just, because the words are right here. The standard that is in current law is the Pollution Control Agency shall improve air quality. That's the standard. That's current law. The proposed change is on lines 6.11 and 6.12, where you are, or the proposal is looking at a federal standard that does not provide adequate protection for public health and the environment. Now, that's a different standard. It's a lesser standard. And here's the problem. Somebody said, and I think it was you, Representative Beard, who said, we don't want to help legions of lawyers. Well, this is a legions of lawyers provision. Because if you've got two different standards in a bill, legions of lawyers will have to come in and try to figure out what this means. Does it mean what's in current law? Does it mean the new thing? What's the standard? A court can take two different approaches here. A court can say, well, we've got to read these two things together, in which case the legions of lawyers will have some grand time. Or the court can say, we'll look at the thing that was most recently enacted into law, which is, does not provide adequate protection for public health, a lesser standard. And I don't think that's where you want to go. There's a third possibility. In this state, we have air and water quality rules that are child-based standards. And that is, a child takes in more air and water per body weight. I think you probably know this. Than the standard of a 160-pound man, which has been the traditional standard. Unfortunately, that's the standard of North Dakota and South Dakota and Iowa and Wisconsin. So how do we read all this together? How does this new standard fit with what Minnesotans have traditionally wanted to do? So I look at that. And then I look at what Mr. Butzik said. And he said Minnesotans have just recently done the constitutional amendment in fine style. And I think Minnesotans understanding was that the money for the constitutional amendment was to clean up old messes, not allow new messes, and we'll use that money to clean up new messes, just to clean up old messes. I don't think Minnesotans want to be on a treadmill of more mess, clean up old mess, create a new mess, clean up the new mess. That's a treadmill. We want off. So, with that, and because I think this does provide ample fodder for legions of lawyers, I want to move to delete Section 4. And, Mr. Chair, to have a conversation about it, I think I'll ask for a roll call.
Okay. Representative Wagenius moves to delete Section 4 and ask for a roll call. Clerk will call roll.
McNamara?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Beard?
Nay.
Dill? Graskowski?
No.
Fabian?
No.
Falk?
Yes.
Hackbarth?
No.
Hancock?
Nay.
Hansen?
Yes.
Hilty?
Aye.
Knuth?
Yes.
Purcell?
Yes.
Quam?
No.
Scott?
No.
Torkelson?
No.
Wagenius?
Yes.
There being 6 ayes and 11 nays, the amendment fails. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fabian, thank you for working on this issue. I do think it is an important issue. I think we're moving a little too quickly because we're going to have such a great source of information from our legislative auditor in a month's time or so. But my questions are on Section 7 and 8. And I'm just would like some information. Maybe you have some data to back this up, but I'm not sure that Section 7 and 8 that would allow a proposer to hire their own consultants to draft environmental impact statement for doing this work, and that the responsible government unit could then review it. My understanding, and you know, granted, I think we still don't have a full understanding of what's causing the delays, and I think when Jim Nobles, the legislative auditor, talked about the agencies being more of a mediator rather than a back and forth with the proposer, you know, we've clearly talked about litigation as part of what may slow this down, and having a good relationship with the citizens is clearly an important part of making an environmental review work effectively and work in a timely manner. And I think the League of Women Voters testify, I appreciate her talking about the fox guarding the hen house. And this, I'm just, can you give me why you think this would speed up the process when you're making it less transparent for citizens or citizens groups, and you're making the responsible government unit have to do things simultaneously or take more time because they haven't been involved in the whole process? It seems to me like it would take more time and cost more with this these two sections.
Mr. Quillis, if you could identify yourself for the record,
please try to not repeat the last. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I, along with Mike Robertson, represent the chamber here up at the Capitol. Representative Knuth, to answer your question, Section 7 and Section 8 are options, not requirement or mandatory. It is an option for a project proposer in this state to contract with a engineering firm, if you will, and we think to submit an environmental impact statement, and we think on the front end it will save cost and time in the process. Right now, when we are assessed for, but the RGU does the contracting with the engineering firm, there are weekends and holidays and other delays involved there. We think if we have a more one-on-one relationship with an engineering firm, a consulting firm, and we're paying the bill, and Mr. Connell frowns every time I do this, they will be working 24/7 to make sure that the adequate data that is required by the RGU and other organizations is done efficiently and quickly and presented to the RGU. The RGU, we're not taking any authority away from them. As you see, they are still going to review, modify. They can determine that that information is not complete or inadequate, and we could go back and do it again. And they're still going to be able to, that's what Section 8 is it allows them, as they're reviewing it, to still assess back to the project proposer to pay for it. And we just wanted to clarify that there.
But thank you, Mr. Quill.
We think that we would save cost and time on the front end.
Representative Knuth, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you have any information or data more than a, you know, a single business testifying? Because I think there are cases where this clearly hasn't worked well. There are many cases where it has worked very well. but that making the collection of data and the production of data and getting better information, or not, I'm not going to say better, but getting the data that is required, I'm just not sure that this is going to speed up anything, and I think it may cost more, and I think it's also going to create more mistrust in this process. And I think that from what I can tell, and I, you know, I'm looking forward to reading the legislative auditor's report, I think that lack of trust and the involvement of the court system can really slow down some of this stuff. And this seems like you're throwing gas on a fire, quite frankly. Throwing gas on the fire because you're pulling information within the proposer. It's not going to be as public. And I don't see how that's going to speed up or make anything less expensive. but you know, I guess we have a difference of opinion there, but I am looking forward to any data that shows this would actually speed it up, because I am not convinced. I think it makes part of the problem much worse.
Representative Knuth, thank you for those comments. Representative Falk. We've got Representative Falk and Representative Hilty, and then we're going to vote on the bill, and Representative Purcell, and then we're going to vote on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to Section 6, and I still have issues with this. I do feel that we have three co-equal branches of government for a purpose, as stated in our Constitution, and that the reason we have those is they are a series of checks and balances. And what the legislation is proposing to do is take over some of the authority granted to the judiciary to go and have a thorough review and to be able to go and operate independently, and really to allow equal access to all people, whether it's an individual citizen, whether it's an entity, whether it's a business, whether it's a nonprofit. I do feel that that is important. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would move to remove Section 6 and request a roll call.
Representative Falk,
I would also call for additional debate. I would like to just have a little bit of discussion to that point.
Okay. To Representative Falk's point, to remove Section 8?
Six.
Sorry, Representative Falk. To remove Section 6, and he's asked for a roll call. Representative Wagenius. And I'll just remind members, I have no problem on having a roll call on deleting each section of the bill one at a time, but our intention is to be out of here by 10 o'clock, and if we don't get out of here by 10 o'clock, we can come back after session. I do not want to do that, but if you want to have long enough discussion within this group about each one of the amendments, we can take the time to do that. Representative Wagenius, to this point.
Mr. Chair, it's not to the point of how much debate to have on an important bill. It is to support Representative Falk, and I think Mr. Thaddeus made actually the best argument for deleting this amendment, and the reason is this. Mr. Thaddeus is a professor of law. He's a specialist, and it takes a specialist to go to a court of appeals. There's no question. There are two different rules of court for the Court of Appeals and the District Court. So generally in your area, Representative Anderson, or in some of your other areas, your attorneys are not going to be specialists. So if citizens in your group, in your area, want to hire somebody to challenge an EIS or a worksheet or any other thing or a permit, they're not going to have the money to hire Mr. Thaddeus. They'll have the money maybe to hire their local attorney, who will not know the rules of court at the Court of Appeals. So this is really an anti-outstate amendment. His amendment supports outstate Minnesota. This provision in the bill is very anti-outstate. And while I am a Minneapolis legislator, I'm very sympathetic to folks in outstate Minnesota having the same rights as the folks in my district have, and I will support Representative Falk.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's amazing how two legislators can see the same question and see exactly opposite conclusions on this thing. The case we had where MCEA, who purports to represent just average citizens, traveled all the way to northwestern Minnesota to sue that poor little county, cost the taxpayers of that county $250,000 to defend themselves. And I have a hunch the average citizens who were in angst about cleaning up the ditch, none of whom resided in the county that cleaned the ditch, I might add, were probably all Minneapolis or Twin City kind of people who donated their dollars to send that group up there to assault that county with a lawsuit. If we could have short-circuited the purpose, and I'm not sure about this, perhaps you can tell us, Representative Fabian, once they launched the lawsuit in district court, did it indeed proceed eventually to the Court of Appeals, or was the whole thing $250,000 just to settle it in district court? Because I have a hunch if these things, and even if this case is not doesn't come to the Court of Appeals, I can think of 100 other cases where this happens, where it has to go to district court. The taxpayers of the small entity that are being sued get to pick up the bill, and then they have to come down here to St. Paul and do it again in district court. Same thing all over again. Having it go right to district court, which is pretty much a foregone conclusion when you have highly financed special interest groups driving the train, just strikes me as a prudent thing to do. Outcomes will probably be the same. Taxpayers will be saved a lot of money, and the poor folks that are just trying to do good work will have half of their calendar freed up so they can actually do useful things. I would urge us to continue to or oppose the motion that's been made and leave this in the bill.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the motion, I have other comments.
I don't need to have you pull the mic down. I can hear you just very well, Representative Purcell.
To the motion. I just want to remind folks, and it's about this outstate. I'm outstate, and I think it was Mr. Peterson in his testimony said, you know, folks from outstate are going to have to travel to St. Paul if we go through with this, and we can say, well, they may, Court of Appeal may come out to regionally out to our areas of the state, and the way we're cutting the courts, we know the likelihood of that. So I just want to remind folks, and I'm just going to bring it up, it's something that kind of burns me, going back to the Declaration of Independence, the fourth usurpation, and I advise you all to read that. I'm not going to tell you what it is. I want you to read it. I want you to find out what it is. Those of you who consider yourself constitutional scholars and formation of this country. But it talks about having places of legal documents distant from where we live. And this is what we're doing here. We're forcing people to go long distances, a long ways down here. And I support Representative Baltimore.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For on this issue, Section 6 was part of House File 3079 by Representative Hortman in 2010, and it was supported, that bill was supported by MCEA, and this redundancy in the courts, I think, my feeling is you're adding additional burden to the courts. And the streamlining actually would save the court's time and effort. Thank you.
Representative Quam, I'm impressed with your knowledge of past legislature. Thank you. Representative Falk.
Quick point to that.
To your motion.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Quam, I made this exact same motion last year, too, to remove the section, so I'm being very consistent.
Good point. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, I think it's important to note, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam is right. MCEA did support that. Not all of these things are local units of government in outstate. It may be the Pollution Control Agency or DNR. So you are putting citizens in outstate Minnesota at a huge disadvantage. And if that is the choice, we'll hear it on the roll call.
Clerk will call the roll on removing Section 6. McNamara, nay.
Anderson?
No.
Beard?
Nay.
Dill?
Yes.
Drazkowski?
No.
Fabian?
No.
Falk?
Yes.
Hackbarth?
No.
Hancock?
Nay.
Hansen?
Yes.
Hilty?
Yes.
Knuth?
Yes.
Purcell?
Yes.
Quam?
No.
Scott?
No.
Torkelson?
Nay.
Wagenius?
Yes.
There being 7 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. To the bill. All those in favor of House File 1 say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Meeting's adjourned.